I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 19th of May. The deadly derailment of an Amtrak train in Philadelphia last week that killed 8 people and wounded more than 200 has us thinking again about the nation's infrastructure. Are tracks in need of repair? What about bridges, roads, ports, schools, the electrical grid? And what's the state of Wisconsin's infrastructure? Joining us this hour is Charles Dinges. He is Senior Managing Director of Public Affairs, Membership, and Marketing for the American Society of Civil Engineers. Once every 4 years, they provide a comprehensive assessment of the nation's major infrastructure categories. They use an A through F school report card format. And since 1998, the grades have been near failing, averaging only D's due to delayed maintenance and underinvestment. The 2013 report card, the latest, shows that our cumulative GPA for infrastructure rose slightly to a D+. We'll talk about why this hour and what areas of our infrastructure need immediate repair. And welcome your phone calls, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Charles, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Kathleen. Good to be with you today.
Tell us about how you do this. You do this every 4 years, and what do you look at?
We're up to 16 categories.
Oh my goodness!
Of infrastructure, I think we started maybe we had 12 or 13 that back in 1998. And it was actually the federal government, I should say, that did the first infrastructure report card back in 1988, and that was a little provision that had been slipped into a water resources development bill back during the Reagan administration to set up a national commission to look at infrastructure. So in 1988, the federal government came out with a report called Fragile Foundations, and it used a similar, you know, A to F system to look at infrastructure. So on the 10-year anniversary of that report in 1998, we felt like we should take another look at it because it seemed that Congress and much of the nation had lost interest in the issue. But to get back to your question, so 16 categories, and I can just rattle them off quickly and people can understand, I think, exactly what I'm talking about. These are the systems that make our everyday and modern life and economy a reality in the United States. So aviation gets a D. Bridges, a C+, actually one of the higher grades on the report card. Dams, a D. Drinking water infrastructure, a D. And what I mean by there is the infrastructure that conveys the water, not the quality of the water itself. And I know years ago you had a drinking water crisis in Milwaukee.
Yes,
we
did.
I just wanted to parenthetically mention that to people. Energy, a D+. Hazardous waste, a D. Inland waterways, a key surface transportation system for the United States, D-. Levees, D-. Ports, a C. Public parks and recreation, C-. Rail, a C+. Actually, that grade moved up from a C- in 2009, so the grade for rail infrastructure made the greatest advance in the last few years. Roads, a D. Schools, a D. Solid waste, a B-. That's the highest grade on this report card. Transit, a D. Wastewater, a D. The average cumulative GPA, I think you already referenced, a D+. A total funding need by the year 2020 of $3.6 trillion. I realize that's a huge number. $2 trillion of that is met through existing funding streams and revenue sources. So the gap, if you will, is $1.6 trillion. And this was an 8-year projection we did in 2013 going out to 2020. So if you annualize that, we're really talking about an infrastructure investment deficit of $200 billion a year. Again, a big number, but on a U.S. economy of $16 trillion, we would submit that it's a doable challenge when you look at all levels of government and the private sector fully engaging in this issue. An important challenge because we really can't have a strong economy if we don't have a strong infrastructure system underneath it.
Well, Charles, with such a disastrous report card, it has incredible ramifications. It has potentially disastrous ramifications, does it not?
It does. If you think about just look at roads, for example, in this country. And I guess, you know, people experience roads got a D, by the way. And it's one of our most visible categories because most people use our road system at some point. during the day and has the biggest funding gap. Total needs by the year 2020 of $1.7 trillion.
Ooh.
Estimated funding of $877 billion. So the funding gap there is about $850 billion over 8 years. But we experience roads in two ways. Maybe, you know, folks in Milwaukee or if you're getting down to the Chicago area, you can experience kind of that urban congestion that can happen on the highways during rush hour, even on weekends in this country now. It seems like every car that could be on the road is
yes.
on the weekends. And we certainly in the Washington area experience a lot of congestion. But the other issue are road conditions themselves. You know, we came through... We had a tough winter here. I imagine it was pretty tough up where you guys are, too. You know, a lot of potholes, a lot of impact on the roads. And, you know, those impacts, you know, affect people. But they're also, in terms of, you know, their wallet and having to, you know, fix the suspension or the shock absorbers or, you know, the axles on their cars. But just looking at the safety issue, in the United States, every year about 30,000 people lose their lives driving on the roads. That number's actually gone down, so that's a, you know, a pleasant surprise, if you will, from... I think it was as high as like 36 or 37,000 just a few years ago. So more focus on safety, better enforcement of drunk driving laws, just, you know, better levels of awareness by drivers, safer cars. But still, 30,000 is a big number. Roughly a third of those, about 10,000 a year, it seems that road conditions and obsolete road design issues may be factors, contributing factors or major factors in a third of those fatalities. So if people were to focus on that more and realize that as many as 10,000 of their fellow Americans may be losing their lives every year because of road conditions, I think people would have a stronger reaction and would be more interested in moving forward on this issue. I should mention parenthetically that the Highway Trust Fund, which supports the road programs in every state in this country, in fact, 40% of the capital investment in highways in Wisconsin comes out of the Highway Trust Fund every year. This trust fund is going to go bankrupt by May 31st, end of next week, unless Congress acts.
Mm. Why is it that we let things get to a point where they're dangerous or they're very, very old? You look at the pipes, the water system, and some of these schools that were built for the baby boom generation. A lot of these facilities are getting really old, and we wait for sometimes 100 years to make the pipes better or to make the schools better. Why in the world don't we take care of things as you would in your home just for maintenance?
Well, it's a good question. I'm not sure. Not sure I know the answer because we do spend a lot of time trying to educate the public, the media, and political leaders about the issue. I think your analogy to a house is a good one. Or even Senator Sanders, who's running for president, I noticed, has been talking a lot about infrastructure. He had a very good analogy the other day. He says, you know, we treat our infrastructure like a cavity. It'd be, sure, you want to ignore it for a while, but if you do, you know it's just going to get worse and it's going to cost more and, you know, it just... you know, be a bigger problem if you deal with it in the future. A house is a similar thing. You know, if you've got a small leak in the roof, it's better to get on it early before you have other damage to the house. But, you know, people, I think, just, you know, take these systems for granted. A lot of it's underground. You know, you mentioned water and the pipes. Here's a quick fun fact. I'll try to throw a few out during our call today.
Okay.
A water main breaks in the United States every 2 minutes.
Really?
Yeah. And a lot of them are over 100 years old, but even pipes that are 50 years old, but they had a 50-year design life, even those are in question. People might recall the big water main break in Los Angeles. Was it, I think, last year we had part of the UCLA campus, you know, flooded by what was just a 55-year-old pipe breaking. So a lot of these systems are underground. So those are easy to not think about because, you know, we really don't think about water until we turn the tap and there is no water. Or a water main breaks and you suddenly have a street flooded. You know, here in Washington, when it happens, you have the transit system can get shut down, surface streets can get shut down, electricity has to be turned off in certain areas. Think about New Orleans and Katrina, the
right.
flooding there. They're the failure, and this kind of gets to the interconnectedness of these systems. They're the failure of part of their flood control system and their levee system. Took out practically all the infrastructure of the city, the water system, the wastewater system, the roads. You had bridges literally floated off their piers. So as we go forward, it'll be important to not just think about the systems as individual systems, but try to see how they interconnect.
Does it take, we're doing this show partially because of the Amtrak derailment last week that killed 8 people, 200 were injured. It made us think, how safe are our railroads? Do we need tracks replaced, et cetera? I'm thinking of the bridge that collapsed in Minneapolis a few years ago. Does it take an event like that for us to really pay attention and to give money to infrastructure?
Unfortunately, those events do capture the public's attention. And, you know, regardless of the causes of some of these incidences, it does, you know, create an opportunity for people to talk about the infrastructure. For example, in the case of the Amtrak accident in Philadelphia, you know, the rail infrastructure is actually, as the report card indicated, kind of a decent, you know, good story over the last 2 years. You know, the rail companies stepped up during the recession. They saw an opportunity to make investments. The cost of borrowing was low. The cost of construction materials was low. You had a lot of unemployment in the construction sector, so it was easier to get workers. So there's an example, I think, of the private sector being maybe a little more nimble and on top of their game and using that as an opportunity to invest. So, you know, the freight railroads have invested upwards of $15 to $20 billion a year over the last several years to get their infrastructure improved. Amtrak also benefited a bit from the President's Recovery and Reinvestment Act in 2009, as did some of the other infrastructure categories. But people should realize that the Recovery Act, sometimes it's called the Stimulus Bill in 2009, that was about $800 billion, but only about $150 billion was tied to what we would call infrastructure investment. Roads, bridges, water systems, you know, airports, things like that. The rest of it, you know, the vast majority, another $650 billion, was really in the form of tax cuts to help the economy and then also transfer payments to the states and local governments. So it was sometimes called an infrastructure investment bill. And early on, I think there was a lot of interest in using it to push a big infrastructure agenda. But in the end, it turned out to be a relatively modest infrastructure bill that was passed back then.
When you look at the 16 categories, do you put them in order of most pressing need?
No, it's a big enough lift for us to just do the 16 categories. It's hard to say, you know, which ones you have to move on first. I mean, you know, something like water, you know, we need that every day to survive. So some people might say, you know, water should be the top investment. You could be a community that really depends on its connection to the inland waterway system and the ports for, you know, imports and export economic activity. You know, that could be really important to your community, so that might be your priority. In other places, it could be, you know, just the condition of the roads, the bridges. Here's another quick fact on the bridges. So every day in this country, there are 200 million trips taken over structurally deficient bridges in the 100 largest cities in America.
And you say in Wisconsin, you gave us Wisconsin statistics, there are 1,198 structurally deficient bridges in our state.
Right. That's true. And that, I think, is slightly above the national average. I think the national average is about 1 in 9 bridges are structurally deficient. Let me just, you know, that might sound like kind of a technical term to people. That does not mean that is a structure that is about to collapse, just to reassure people. But it is a structure that requires more attention and focus. So structures that are deficient in that way are inspected every year as opposed to every 2 years, which is the norm. And so people should... And engineers, if they feel that a bridge is near a breaking point, they'll shut down a bridge completely. And before that, they'll post a bridge. They'll restrict the size of vehicles and the weights of loads that can go over a structure if necessary.
Well, that assumes that you have enough people to do that kind of inspection, right?
Yes. I think they feel, the bridge grade was a C+. You know, we do have a national bridge inventory. I think the states and the federal government work together pretty well, keeping an eye on the 607,000 bridges that comprise the U.S. Road system.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Charles. We're talking about the nation's public infrastructure this hour of the program, which shame on us, I guess we should have done long before the Amtrak crash last week, but we are doing this now because those events make us think about the infrastructure, and we're going beyond the train tracks. We're looking at 16 categories of the infrastructure in this country, and it doesn't get very good marks. That's a bit of an understatement. This is a report card for America's infrastructure. It's the 2013 report card. It's done every 4 years by the American Society of Civil Engineers. We welcome your phone calls on this. Are there areas of the infrastructure that you worry about? Do we let this go? And why would we let this go for such a long period of time until there are bursts of water pipes, or water pipes are so old that we may be worried about the water that's going through the pipes? What about levees? Even after Katrina, we have all these levees that aren't doing very well. There are other areas, of course, solid waste, hazardous waste, aviation, bridges, inland waterways, ports in this country, transit, roads, also not in very good shape, public parks and recreation, schools in the country. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Are there areas that are of concern to you? Do you think that we need federal money coming in to repair the nation's infrastructure? It would help create some jobs, perhaps, as well. Casey, our guest, or Charles, I think he likes to be called Casey. I'll call him Casey. That's good. Is the Senior Managing Director of Public Affairs Membership and Marketing for the American Society of Civil Engineers. We'll be with you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, the nation's infrastructure, and we're welcoming your phone calls at 800-486-8655. Casey Dinges is our guest, Senior Managing Director, Public Affairs, Membership and Marketing for the American Society of Civil Engineers, which was founded in 1852. George in Presque Isle, hi.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have one question. How much of our railroad system is owned by foreign countries, such as Canada or Japan, etc.? I'll take the answer off the phone.
All right, George, thanks.
I do not know the answer to that question. There's about 160,000 miles that make up the national railway network, and Amtrak, which is a public entity, owns only about 730 miles of that. So that leaves the vast preponderance, over 159,000 miles, with the railroads. Hmm. But in terms of foreign ownership of the roads, I can't answer that.
Yeah, I think that may be prompted, and I only heard bits and pieces, so my information is not complete, but I heard something on the radio this morning about the Chinese building this huge, is it all covering the length of South America? They're in the process of building this, which struck me as the Chinese are doing this. It was unusual, but I don't know much more than that.
They are certainly building high-speed rail networks in China, and it wouldn't surprise me, since they are developing that technology, that they would start exporting it to other countries, if that's what you're getting at. But that is, you hear a lot of envy among rail aficionados about high-speed rail in Western Europe and in parts of Asia, and the U.S. is nowhere near having a real high-speed rail system.
Thanks, George. Betsy in River Falls. Hi.
Hi, I hope this applies. After the spill in West Virginia, when all that garbage went into the river, I went to City Hall and I talked to three people. One, a clerk, who told me to go home and make cookies, and city inspector, who kind of implied also that I should go home and make cookies, and the mayor of the town, who took me more seriously. But I said, are we doing all the things that we can do to protect it, make sure that nothing bad happens in the city? I don't know what kind of businesses we have. I don't know if there are any chemical spills that can happen, but I just am concerned. And their attitude was, we could take care of a problem if it happens. And my concern was, let's have it not happen, because that must be cheaper and better for the environment. That's my question.
Casey.
Well, I think you're getting at water pollution issues there, if I get the question. Specifically, you're talking about contamination can occur when you have an industrial accident, and then you suddenly have contaminants going straight into a river system. In terms of the overall infrastructure in the water and wastewater area, I see total needs by 2020 of $126 billion, estimated funding of $42 billion, and investment gap of only $84 billion over 8 years. So we're saying that for just $10 billion a year, the U.S. could make considerable headway in the water infrastructure and the wastewater infrastructure areas. And just one other comment about water pollution. This is more of a general comment that I think the nation needs to think about. The U.S. passed the Clean Water Act in 1972, and it's gone a long way to helping the U.S. clean up, its rivers and lakes. We haven't quite reached the goal of making every body of water fishable and swimmable, but we've certainly, come a long way. The U.S., we still have, a ways to go on this, and it's important that, we keep focused on this. These investments are vital. We did a good job of eliminating what are called point sources of pollution. Those could be, city sewer plants. Water has to be treated to a certain level before it gets put back into a waterway. The challenge that the U.S. has is how to deal with the agricultural sector and the runoff that, we experience in watersheds in many parts of the country from the agricultural sector into waterways. This is a problem in the East Coast with the Chesapeake Bay and the water systems that come out of, upstate New York and Pennsylvania, rural parts of the country, and that feed into those systems. So we've done a lot on the point source issue. I think it's the non-point source issue that's the big hang-up for the country now.
Thanks for the call. Let's go next to Kelly in Luxembourg. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. Well, I'm really concerned that we're not spending enough money when it comes to taking care of our transportation system. It concerns me that we're borrowing all this money. I just don't feel like the governor's doing a good job.
How much of this is state responsibility and how much is federal responsibility, Casey?
That's a good question, Kathleen. I think, if you look at the numbers, about a third of all investment in surface transportation comes from the federal government, and then two-thirds comes from the states and local government. But it is a very big sector. I agree with the caller that we haven't invested enough. Let me just say, I mentioned earlier that the Highway Trust Fund will expire on May 31st unless Congress acts. Congress has passed about 30 short-term extensions of this program in recent years. It's had a hard time of putting together a 5 or 6 year program that would be most helpful to the states from a planning perspective. One other thing about the Federal Highway Program, and this program also supports transit systems in metropolitan areas, and that is that the funding mechanism for this program is called the Federal User Fee or the Federal Gasoline Tax. This is an 18-cent per gallon tax. So every time you buy a gallon of gas, 18 cents, or I should say just 18 cents of that, is going into the Highway Trust Fund. This tax was never adjusted for inflation, and it was last addressed in 1993, so it has lost 40% of its purchasing power since that time, and this explains why we're at a funding crisis on the federal transportation program.
And certainly nobody running for office wants to say what we need is an increase in the federal tax.
Well, it
right?
would be an act of leadership. I might
yes.
point out that a number of states have been doing that. And let me just see, I wrote some of these down, and these are just in the past, just this year, Idaho, Iowa, Utah, Georgia, Nebraska, and there's one other I couldn't nail down here. They've all raised their state gas taxes this year, and none of the states I just mentioned are what I would call bastions of liberalism mm-hmm. and overspending. So red states and blue states are looking at this issue. And I think, looking at it critically and honestly and realizing that, some of these user fees that we use to support these transportation programs have not been addressed for a number of years, and the states are stepping up and addressing it, but they're doing it with the hope and expectation that Washington is not going to drop the ball on this.
Mm-hmm. Facebook comment from Joe, unless Bernie Sanders is elected president or someone who wants to create jobs by investing in infrastructure, expect the decline to continue until it's an F. Clinton may swing her message to be more progressive until after the primary, but don't be fooled.
I'm not sure I can comment on the politics of this other than to say I think infrastructure is an important bipartisan issue for the nation. Major progress has been made under Republican administrations and Democratic administrations. If you look back in history, the Transcontinental Railroad, Abraham Lincoln, a Republican, the Interstate Highway System, President Eisenhower, a Republican, the Clean Water Act in 1972, Richard Nixon, a Republican. So it is not just the Democrats that are pushing for this. In fact, if you look at the U.S. Senate, you've got Barbara Boxer from California, one of the most liberal senators, and then the chairman of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, James Inhofe of Oklahoma, one of the most conservative senators in the Senate. Yet on this issue, they seem to be able to walk together to advocate for increased investment. I hope that we don't get down to an F before the nation and our political leaders wake up to the importance of this issue. And just back to the jobs connection on this.
Yes.
I mean, if we're concerned about the slow recovery we're having, if we're concerned about the types of jobs, good paying jobs, having jobs that people can have that can help support a family, it's hard to not think about infrastructure as an important piece in a program like that, because in the construction sector, the jobs are tough, they're demanding, but they're relatively high-paying jobs. And then there's the economic development that occurs after the infrastructure has been put into place. So I think if we're going to have an honest discussion about improving employment opportunities in this country, I think infrastructure investment should be one of the first things we're looking at.
And when you're looking at a 50% unemployment rate in many of our central cities, all you have to do is look at a jobs program like this and make the connection that that would ease unemployment in those central cities substantially.
Sure, sure. It would be a boon. It would help business. It would make the nation more competitive economically. I've seen scores of economic studies for, every dollar that's invested in infrastructure, there's $1.70 in economic benefit attributed to that. And just even further, we did a series of economic studies called the Failure to Act. They're easy to find on our website or Google. Just, look under ASCE, Failure to Act. And what we found was really quite remarkable. And if the U.S. were to invest roughly $150 billion, and this could be at all levels of government and the private sector, $150 billion for 8 years in a row, we would protect $3.1 trillion in U.S. GDP. That's the equivalent of Germany's entire GDP. We would protect $1.1 trillion in U.S. trade value. That's the equivalent of Mexico's GDP. We would protect 3.5 million jobs. We would protect $2.4 trillion in consumer spending, comparable to Brazil's GDP, and also $3,100 in annual personal disposable income for U.S. families. Mm-hmm. So, the question really shouldn't be, can we afford to invest? The question should be, can we afford not to invest?
Kelly, thanks for your call. Our number 800-486-8655. Paul in Monona, hi.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
Some people don't seem to make that connection, the idea and the importance of taking care of infrastructure and how it also creates jobs. And I would tie it to politics, and I would say more progressive ideas seem to make that connection. And I think the people that show up for midterm elections and low voter turnout elections and win the majority of that seem to be people very conservative that want much less government and seem to be thinking that it would be great to have no government at all and no taxes. And then if you have that, then that also eliminates oversight because you have public employees that oversee the construction and make sure that contractors follow the bid specs and things. And so I would say that it's very political, because some people do not react to situations like that till a bridge falls in and somebody they know or love gets killed or some other thing like that, and it hits them right between the eyes. Then it's like, oh, reactionary. Whoa, we got to do something about that.
Casey.
It's a good point. In terms of the politics of this, you've got, I'm seeing there are a lot of coalitions working on this infrastructure issue, but you've got the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO leadership and grassroots and a lot of organizations in between working together on this. So when you've got a coalition that broad, I think it speaks to the fact that there's probably a silent majority across this country that really does care about this issue and expects, you know, something to be done.
Mm-hmm.
I do hope, though, the issue can remain bipartisan. It always has been a bipartisan issue in this country. You know, you've got business and labor, and, you know, the mayors, we've got governors, you know, state legislators, you know, the contractors, the engineering community, a lot of people pulling together and pushing on this. People, the other aspect of the politics is, I think, at the grassroots level, and individual citizens, when they're encountering their legislators, whether it's a county commissioner, you know, a state senator, a member of Congress, your governor, whoever, somebody running for president will be showing up in your state pretty soon, I'm sure, and buttonholing these people and saying, look, infrastructure has to be a priority. And once it becomes more of a top-of-mind issue for the average citizen, I think it'll be easier for political leaders to cast the kind of courageous votes that need to occur on this.
Let's go back to some of these, at least one. There are so many different categories, but this levy, for heaven's sake, we're not that far away from Katrina, where a major city was almost destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
Levies in your report getting a near failing grade. After all of that, a D-. Public safety remains at risk from these aging structures. The cost to repair, $100 billion. However, the return on investment is clear. Obviously, it's clear. You keep a city or an area from being flooded. How could we live through Katrina and not do something about the levees for $100 billion, which is a drop in the bucket compared to a federal budget, and keep our cities safe?
You know, it's a fair question, and it's interesting how we, crises and catastrophes occur. You had mentioned the Minneapolis bridge collapse earlier. Congress couldn't even get a vote within 2 months of the Minneapolis bridge collapse on just targeting the structurally deficient bridges on the national highway system.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people have short memories on this. You know, they just kind of move on to other things. But, you know, levies, that's one of the newer categories we've actually, you know, added to the report card. And right now, I mean, the U.S. doesn't even have a handle on how many miles of levees we actually have in the United States. We think it's about 100,000 miles of levees. There was a levee safety program that was included in the Water Resources Development Act that passed. I'm trying to think. This one passed just a couple of years ago. So the federal government, through the Army Corps of Engineers, is just beginning to get going on that program, but it is a very modest program right now. Let me say one thing about levees and flood control for people so that, you know, we understand. People might recall back in 2011, there was a huge flood on the Mississippi River. It may have been more downriver from folks in the Wisconsin area, more in the central U.S., you know, southern Illinois. But basically, the U.S., through the Corps of Engineers, was able to operate a number of floodgates and open up floodways. There was even the destruction of a levee to open up one of the floodways to take on floodwaters down in the Missouri area. And the U.S. had made these investments years ago, and the operation of those floodgates and the management of what was a historic flood in 2011, was able to prevent over $140 billion in damage to cities downriver in the United States. So people need to understand that when we make these investments, they pay off big time for the United States.
Let's go to Ray in Rhinelander. Hi, Ray.
Hi. I want to bring up some information related to public transportation funds. The state of Wisconsin was offered, when Governor Walker came in, some federal revenue in reference to state transportation funds. He refused those. The offshoot of that is that if he would have accepted those, and correct me if I'm wrong, you know, that money also would have went into other public transportation for infrastructure, for related bridges, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and what's really ridiculous about all that is that we pay all these taxes anyways. All of us pay into the pool. Why wouldn't somebody accept that? And also, you know, here's another fact, okay, and I hate to bring this up. When you're funding two wars for 12 years, you know, if we would have that money to put into each state to take care of infrastructure, schools, et cetera, we'd all be operating in the black. But, you know, there's a lot of politics with this stuff, and I'll take your comment off the air. Thank you.
All right, Casey. Thanks, Ray.
Well, you know, there's, I guess, the whole guns and butter debate is one that's gone on in this country for a long time. I would submit that the U.S. infrastructure is so important that if we're even going to consider having a strong economy, much less a strong national defense, we have to have the proper infrastructure in place. So, you know, these are really foundational systems we need upon which we can build a strong economy, and then upon that we can have a strong national defense. If we don't have a strong national economy, we're not going to have a strong national defense. So that's one comment there. The other comment about the rail issue, I think what the caller was referring to was the high-speed rail proposal.
Yes.
From the administration. And what that involved, I don't recall the exact numbers, but Washington was going to put up part of the investment, and I'm sure it was in the tens of billions, it was in the billions of dollars, but it would have required an investment by the state considerably more than that. Whatever the Washington amount was, the state would be on the hook for more. So that's a partnership, and it was, you know, up to each one of the, I think these rail systems were proposed in, I think, 8 or 10 regions across the country. So it really did, you know, fall to the states to decide at that point, do they want to take this money from Washington and then also make a commensurate investment or perhaps even a bigger investment to actually build out a high-speed rail system. So, you know, those are the kinds of decisions that leaders have to make. You see that it's starting to move forward in California, certainly in the Northeast Corridor, you know, where we just had this train incident this past week. You certainly have enough demand to consider building a system like that. It's also, though, very expensive to build a new track bed for a high-speed rail system through the Northeast United States.
Mm-hmm.
So high-speed rail, I think, still has a ways to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're all interconnected. And by the way, I think Florida took that money. There were people who wanted the money. But they're interconnected. So part of the reason for the roads being perhaps in disrepair is so many people are on the roads because you don't have good mass transit.
Well, it's a fair point. Mass transit provides, you know, people who are riding the road system, you know, they see a train go by or a transit, you know, mode go by, they should kind of wave and smile because those people are making it a little easier for you to drive on the road that day. So that's a good point about the interconnectedness.
And this, I guess, points to our priorities again, but this is, in a way, somewhat dumbfounding. Chris, on another email message, wants to know how we can spend an incredible amount of money to rebuild the infrastructure of Iraq, but we can't rebuild our own infrastructure.
Again, that's we're getting to the realm of foreign policy there. So, you
right.
know, I mean, once you've committed the military into a country, there is a certain amount of, you know, hearts and minds that you're trying to win over. And there's always the belief that infrastructure investment can help do that in countries. I will say, if we want to think about infrastructure, you know, more globally, and you know, we mentioned that the infrastructure, the grade for water was a D. You know, there are still a billion people on this planet that cannot count on clean, uncontaminated drinking water every day, and there's 2 billion people that can't count on clean sanitation every day. So, you know, if the U.S. were to think about trying to make an impression on the rest of the world and win over some hearts and minds, I think trying to help people get to fresh sources of drinking water on a daily basis could make quite an impression.
We're welcoming phone calls. Casey Dingus is our guest this hour. He is the Senior Managing Director of Public Affairs, Membership, and Marketing for the American Society of Civil Engineers. We are talking about the nation's infrastructure, and once every 4 years, his organization does a very thorough examination of our infrastructure in many different categories, 16 different categories, and each gets an A through F grade. And the overall grade since 1998 have been near failing. And this year, our cumulative GPA for infrastructure went up a wee little bit to a D+. So we're talking about what that means and why we don't take care of our infrastructure, what are the political obstacles to doing that, and also a very thorough examination of all that needs to be done. Our phone number lines have been really crowded. A lot of you care about this issue, which is a good thing. We have some lines open right now, and there are several ways you can reach us. The phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter, @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, back to phone calls, and let's go to Weston in Platteville next. Hi, Weston.
Hi. I just had a question for Casey. So from what I understand, I'm not a civil engineer by any means, but from what I understand, the concrete on the interstate road is only like 4 to 6 inches thick. And I've heard that in Germany, when they built the Autobahn, that concrete's like 24 inches thick or something. And it just seems to me like we're always doing road construction, trying to maintain these roads. And I think I'm just curious as to why we don't put more emphasis in the materials, you know, to build a road that will last for 50 or 60 years without having to get rebuilt again. You know, it's to save on labor. It might cost additional materials now, but, you know, we would save money in the long run.
Hmm. You know, you raise a really good point, and it's a broader point than just, you know, how thick the concrete is on roads. I think you're right. I'm not sure it's quite that thick on the Autobahn in Germany, but I do think some of the Western European nations do have kind of a thicker amount of concrete used on the surface of the road, and they do seem to last a bit longer. The issue that you're getting at is what we call life cycle costs, and that is that when we think about infrastructure investment, you know, we're building sometimes projects that are going to last 50 or 100 years, or some of these new signature bridges you see built are designed for, you know, 125 or 150 years. So you're thinking very long term. So you're thinking, what is the initial upfront cost to design and build that structure? But you also have to think about the maintenance costs for that structure for the long term. So I think that government at all levels, federal, state, and local, should be looking at their investments and trying to make a, if you will, a wise decision. Okay, what if I pay a little bit more up front? Will I be lowering the maintenance costs on this structure? Will I be making it easier for, you know, my successors in political office or future generations to get the most out of this facility? So, you know, sometimes in our political environment, we think very short term. We think 2-year, 4-year horizons. But with infrastructure, we need to think much longer. And the idea of spending a little bit more up front to have a better performing, lower cost maintenance facility in the long run is something we should think about.
Thank you, Weston. Good question. Tom, Madison, hi.
Yes, hello. Again, a great show. The question I have kind of follows up from, I think, an earlier remark that the report card doesn't really have, like, prioritized categories. But when I think of infrastructure, I think of it as all kind of interconnected. And if we've got a D+, where would you begin? Is there any kind of way to, you know, kind of coordinate everything that needs to get done to maybe get to a C or a B? And I'll take my call off the line.
Thank you, Tom.
Well, you know, we have advocated a program of increasing investment by $157 billion a year for 8 years, and that would get us up to about a level of B across all the categories. But to speak more broadly about, you know, what we need to do to raise the grades, we really have kind of a three-pronged approach. One is to increase leadership and infrastructure renewal. The issue really needs bold leadership and a compelling vision at the national level. That's not something we have. You know, Eisenhower said, we're going to build the interstates and connect this country, and it happened. So, you know, we don't really have something like that now. The second issue is what we call promote sustainability and resilience. Sustainability, what I mean by that is the project or what you're trying to build, environmentally sustainable, economically sustainable, and socially sustainable. So those are, it's like a three-legged stool you have to address when you look at infrastructure now. Then the second issue deals with resilience. And especially when you're working in coastal environments, you know, with the issue of climate change and sea level rise that's going on, we have to think very long term, and we have to think about building facilities that will be resilient enough to withstand current and future challenges. Then the third issue is develop and fund plans to maintain and enhance America's infrastructure. This is at all levels of government, and it will probably also involve, to some extent, more levels of private investment.
It is hard, as you're talking here, Casey, when you say $157 billion, it seems like a lot of money. And yet you look at, I'm sorry, it's just hard to not look at where money is being spent and to look at the amount of money that's spent on one plane that's going to drop bombs that maybe are going to hit its target or not hit its target. And those are huge, huge amounts of money. It just doesn't seem like all that much money, does it?
Well, you know, it depends. I used to think $157 billion was a lot of money.
Right.
After working on this issue for a long time, you know, it is only 1% of the entire GDP.
Really?
In the United 1%? States. Yeah, if you look at our GDP of roughly $15.5 to $16 trillion, $157 billion is just 1% of that. And you consider how foundational and how fundamental those investments are to even having an economy, to even having a strong national defense. I think people realize, you know, these are smart investments that need to be made. And people should look at it as an investment, not as spending.
Have you testified before Congress?
Oh, yeah. We do that a lot.
When most recently? And what did they say to you?
The members of Congress that we're often testifying in front of are the committees that do care a lot about this issue. So we actually find a lot of support from Democrats and Republicans on committees like the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee in the House. Congressman Petri of Wisconsin was a very active member of that committee for a long time before he retired. And then in the Senate, the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, and there are a couple of other committees in the Senate, too. So those committees that are closest to the issue seem to have a fairly decent level of bipartisan support and interest. It's when you get to the rest of Congress and the other members that maybe people need a little more education and wisdom, particularly if they're hearing about it from their own constituents.
And you have to believe that these issues are close to the American people.
Absolutely. I think people realize that, you know, this is a good way to generate good jobs in this country, and these are good jobs building good things that the nation needs. So, you know, the nation, I think, we've gotten as far as we have because of the investments the previous generations have made and that we've enjoyed. And I think, you know, this generation now needs to stand up and decide what kind of investments it's going to make so that there's a brighter future for our kids and grandkids.
Richard in Clam Lake, hi.
Hi. My comment is, excuse me, that the loopholes for the filthy rich and privileged and the corporations who get all kinds of tax breaks while we pay our fair share should have to pay their fair share, and we would put this country back on track right now.
All right. Thanks for your comment, Richard. And Wayne in Brookfield is probably our last caller. Hi, Wayne.
Yeah, the comment on the thickness of the Autobahn pavement. The Nazis are building the Autobahn because they're violating the treaties. They weren't supposed to build a war machine. So they built straight stretches of Autobahn so they could have runways to land their heavy aircraft in that. So they made them thicker. They made them like a airport landing strip. I just wanted to inject that.
Oh.
That's an interesting point.
Yes, it is. Thanks, Wayne, for your call. We haven't talked about schools, and we only have about 45 seconds to do it, but a lot of our schools need some repair.
Oh, they certainly do. In fact, I mean, the school's grade, I'm just turning to it, I know it's low. In fact, one of the first report cards we did, I think schools actually got an F.
Oh, my goodness.
But, you know, almost half of America's public school buildings were built to educate the baby boomers, the generation that is now retiring. Public school enrollment is projected to gradually increase through 2019, yet national spending on school construction has declined to approximately $10 billion in the year 2012. About half the level that was spent prior to the recession. Experts now estimate that investment needed to modernize and maintain our nation's schools is about $270 billion. Again, that's a large number, but, you know, again, education, again, kind of a fundamental aspect of this country is the way we educate. You know, people still come from around the world to get educated at American universities. So I think the U.S. still has some strengths in this area, but I think we can better serve our elementary, middle, and high schoolers. If the infrastructure that they have to spend a good part of their lives in getting educated.
Casey, thank you so much. Very interesting hour. Casey Dinge is Senior Managing Director, Public Affairs, Membership, and Marketing for the American Society of Civil Engineers. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks for all of your calls. If you didn't get on the air, leave messages on Facebook so we can all read each other's comments, and that's a good thing. Thanks to KP for on-air production as well here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee.